So how long we got? Where's our destination today?
I don't know. We got 20 miles to cover. Let's talk some movies. People don't know how to drive.
Are we going to get lunch on this gig? You seen anything good recently?
Not really. All right, we got a little time, Steve. Let's do a podcast.
Sounds good. Welcome to Film Driven. I'm Steve Haskin.
And I'm Andre Shane, and we're driving around the scorching streets of Chicago. It's a hot one. And, of course, it's a hot movie summer this
year,
right?
Sure is, yeah.
You know, it's almost impossible to talk about the summer of 2012 without talking about superhero movies. So we're doing what is our second superhero podcast, Steve.
Two of the three biggest movies of the year so far are all superhero movies.
Well, easily of the year, if not the century. I mean,
yeah.
The Avengers was a gigantic hit. And, of course, the wave of these new superhero films started last year with a couple of Marvel films, Thor and Captain America. And, I guess X-Men First Class is kind of a Marvel film as well, although not affiliated with that studio. What did you think of those movies?
Yeah, X-Men First Class is probably the best of those three. I enjoy the cast. I also enjoyed that they just... I like the time period specificness of that movie. That it became a 60s movie involving superheroes.
Yeah,
kind of a cool concept.
Groovy. Yeah, it was a cool concept. It took things out of, you know, out of their normal element. And it was also like a good way to kind of cleverly reboot the X-Men franchise without officially rebooting it. Like, it still feels kind of connected to the other X-Men movies.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel like it's a completely new take on this stuff, which I kind of like.
And leads itself to some, you get to have some fun with wardrobe and art design in that movie.
Totally, totally. And the whole, like, the time period is interesting, you know? It's just, it's kind of cool to have superheroes operating in that more low-tech world than we've seen before. So,
and the best thing about that movie, too, was what are ostensibly the leads. James McAvoy is Charles Xavier and
Michael Fassbender.
Michael Fassbender's Magneto. I thought both of those guys were great in that movie, and their relationship played really well.
Yeah, they carried the movie beautifully, and especially Michael Fassbender, who, I mean, clearly has the more interesting character of those two playing Magneto, and it was fun. I enjoyed the movie. It wasn't perfect. It's had some goofy stuff in it, unquestionably, but I expect that at this point from superhero movies. I think it's almost good to have a little bit of goofiness in those films. I think a little too much seriousness to play it totally straight down the line just doesn't work for me in those films.
Well, yeah, especially when you know, the difference between the X-Men and someone like Batman, you know, Batman obviously has no power. You
right.
know, they're humans who are extreme, certainly,
right.
in their abilities, but no one's a mutant, no one can fly,
right.
No one can turn into some other form of matter.
Exactly.
So once you do enter into that world, which the X-Men clearly do.
Big time.
Then
yes,
it's true to, you know, you should at least have some fun with the fact that, you know, some of your cast members are blue.
There's some wacky powers in the X-Men universe, and many of them are represented in X-Men First Class. But X-Men First Class works pretty well, I thought. And I like the way they tied it into the history of the time. I like the way they ended it with a kind of a separation between the mutant camps. This is really where it was really the origin of not so much the characters, but the break between the more militant mutants and the more, pro-humanity mutants. And I find that kind of interesting. And
yeah, I mean, that's always been one of the interesting aspects of the X-Men comics, was that Magneto was never supposed to be pure evil.
Exactly.
He was actually an old buddy of Professor Xavier. They just had a very profound philosophical difference.
Right. And there's always an aspect in, I mean, it's always been present in the comic books that Magneto may be right. You know,
yeah.
that Magneto may actually have a better point than Charles Xavier and his, like, pro-human mutants. And the comics always play with that, and the movie played with it very well as well. So, pretty good effort, I thought, on the X-Men front. But what did you think of Thor?
I didn't like Thor real well, is the short version of it. It had an interesting thing. I thought the previews for Thor looked real shitty.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing the previews and being like, wow, that's not going to be good. And then the movie came out, and it got surprisingly positive reviews.
It did. It got
and it was a big hit.
Reviews.
Like, the word of mouth was spreading. Yeah. I was like, hey, Thor's pretty fun.
Right.
And then, so I'm like, all right, we'll give Thor a shot. And then when I did give Thor a shot, it actually went right back. They completed the full circle to where, you know, I don't know if everybody going in, including critics, thought that movie was going to be shitty. And then when it was kind of fun, they're like, oh, it's all right. But to me, it was still fairly shitty. I thought the best thing about Thor was Chris Hemsworth, who plays Thor himself. I thought he was a lot of fun. Like,
right.
I bought him as the character. He had a sense of humor. Thor himself was great. I just thought the movie around it was kind of, you know, trudging, and all the Asgard stuff looked not all that great to me.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. Although I enjoyed the stuff that was happening on Asgard more than I enjoyed the stuff that was happening on Earth. I thought when Thor gets exiled to, like, New Mexico, that's when I thought the movie was not that great. Until, there comes a point where, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. captures him and interrogates him and stuff like that. And that part of the movie was okay when he tries to retrieve his hammer for the first time. Chris Hemsworth is an excellent Thor. And since they are already making the next Thor movie, I hope that they can kind of get away from the silliness of this Thor movie, which, again, I thought was dramatically clunky. And I watched it again recently with the kids, and they enjoyed it. But it's not real action-packed. Like, the dramatic arc in it is kind of weak.
And the romance doesn't really work at all.
The romance does not seem to work. And, you know, there should be this... The relationship between Thor and his brother Loki should be a lot more interesting than it actually is in the film. It's not really developed. So Loki doesn't come off strong in the films. He doesn't seem to be particularly evil or wicked. So there's the conflict is really, really kind of low. It's low energy conflict, Steve.
It is. You could argue that all of the Thor movie is just a preview for the Avengers. I even thought that the only reason the Thor movie has a reason to exist is so that way when Thor shows up in the Avengers, you kind of know who he is.
Right, right. You don't have to explain. I mean, Thor is a goofy character to start with.
He is.
Thor is literally a mythological god. Marvel decided to say, hey, here's a... We could use this character and not have to pay any royalties to anybody. And his presence in the Avengers and within the Marvel superheroic universe has always been a little strange, but he is, in fact, you know, a powerhouse.
Well, that's the thing to
power,
me, is that I was never a big Thor guy on his own, but he's a great guy to have on your team.
Yes, I want Thor on my team.
Well, exactly. You're like, oh, do you want this guy who can, like, throw lightning? He has this hammer. And you're like, yeah, that guy's great.
Well, he likes to party. The ladies love him. And he doesn't particularly mind getting punched in the face, too.
No.
You know, so he's a kind of a...
There's an aspect of Thor which is like a lovable football player.
He's
a big,
good
strong
time.
Guy.
He's a good time.
Go out and get hit for you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's
so.
Good people. I'd want him on my superhero team. No question about it. But the movie, not so much. And you're so right on the money that it does seem that the Thor movie was essentially just a big preamble to the Avengers. And as such, it was a little bit weak. Now, I found Captain America considerably better. Captain America I like quite a bit. In fact, I liked it almost as much as I like X-Men First Class, and it holds up well on multiple viewings too. First of all, it I really like the way that film handles the origin of Captain America. Captain America has this, well, Captain America is one of the oldest comic book, like, superhero type characters. He was created just a little bit after probably 1940, 1942, I think he goes to. And he was always, clearly he was designed as this super patriotic character, but
it's right there in the name.
Absolutely. It's, you can't get around it, but it, you know, the movie handled that aspect so well, and it didn't really try to get away from that kind of square patriotic vibe of the character. It kind of embraced that, and it worked. You know, Captain America is not supposed to be the most hip character. He is what he is, and he is unabashedly good, and Chris Evans did an excellent job. I really wasn't sure about his casting.
Yeah, he was way better than I thought he was going to be.
Really? I've only seen him do this kind of smart alecky thing he did in a whole bunch of movies, including Fantastic Four,
which
he played
Human Torch. Yeah.
And he was the best thing in those movies, honestly, because he seemed to be the only person who got how bad they were. But in Captain America, I mean, he really went in a completely different direction. And he was very subdued, very kind of introverted. And it worked for me. I mean, I think, you know, I still think he should be kind of beefier. But you know, that's neither here nor there, Steve. I think he was a fine Captain America. And the movie was cool. It had some fun action. It some good characters, some, you know, genuine emotion, I'd say, even towards the end. And it worked. It was solid, and you know, it kind of really got me excited for the Avengers.
Yeah, I missed that film in the theater. I was unsure about it, and I caught up with it on DVD before the Avengers came out. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's just you know, not the greatest film I've ever seen, but certainly an entertaining, you know, action-packed, fairly family-friendly film. All these, as we've discussed, all these superhero movies with the bigger characters, the first movie is always the origin story,
right,
for better or worse. And so, therefore, a lot of times you're at the mercy of, well, how good is your origin story?
Right.
And the problem with a movie like Thor or Green Lantern is that their origin stories are kind of, especially to people who don't read a lot of comic books, they're weird.
I mean,
for lack of, they're not a something easily identifiable.
No,
there's an alien and Green Lantern literally quality to it. But Captain America's got a great origin story.
Absolutely.
And if you know anything about the history of comic books when these heroes were created, or if, say, you've read The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon, you know that a lot of the creators of these comic books were these kind of nerdy guys around World War II.
Right.
Who really wished that they could do something, you know, in the war effort.
Right.
One way or the other. I mean, many of them, to be blunt, were Jewish, who probably, you know, had wish fulfillment in their creations fighting the Nazis.
Absolutely.
And Captain America is the most literal example of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, the character is a guy who wanted to go fight in World War II, and he was too physically inadequate.
Right.
So he gets this, you know, this crazy scientific serum, and suddenly he becomes the ultimate soldier.
Right.
And with his morality intact.
That's
and
right.
It's a great
story. Just
a boy
from Brooklyn who gets superpowers and gets to kick some Nazi ass.
Yeah, and so they made, again, like X-Men First Class, they didn't try and modernize the story. They kept it in its... They just embraced that World War II.
Yeah, it's a World War II film, no question about it.
And made kind of an Indiana Jones-ish adventure flick.
Right, right.
One of the best things they did, which it seems almost too on the head, is if you've ever seen the movie The Rocketeer.
Right.
The Rocketeer takes place at a similar time, and you're like, oh, that's an entertaining, you know, kind of superhero movie.
Right.
Well, somebody at Marvel thought that, too, because they had just hired the director of The Rocketeer.
They just hired George Johnson, the director
Captain
of The
America.
Rocketeer. Absolutely.
And
he did a fine job. And another great thing is they hired Hugo Weaving to play the Red Skull. And
Hugo Weaving is
great. I mean, again, this guy, you know, who can we put in a full face mask and still bring forth a character? And that was clearly Hugo Weaving. I love the choices he made. I love the fact that the Red Skull kind of sounds like Werner Herzog. And he was kind of lovable in his own crazy
Nazi way. That
would have
been an even better choice.
Werner Herzog. Do I actually get Werner Herzog? The thing is, Werner Herzog, the actor, is a little bit weaker than Werner Herzog.
I think he would have wandered off script quite a bit.
I think so. And I think when there's the big fist fight between him and Captain America at the end, I think it would have been hard to buy Werner Herzog potentially kicking
there are stunt doubles.
Cap's ass in that scene. But whatever. It's good choice with Hugo Weaving, and he was a fun villain, and the movie just had a lot of fun little things, references and stuff like that. And that sort of brings me to the overall thing where, you know, a lot of times these movies, individually, they may not be the greatest movies ever made. I mean, certainly nobody's going to argue otherwise, but a lot of times these movies are a great sum of their individual parts. And while they may not come together quite to be the lean machine that a truly great movie is supposed to come together as, I do have to say that those individual moments can be so delightful that if you just add up enough of them, it seems like you just saw a really good movie. Another thing that I noticed in the past couple of years since we did our last podcast on the superhero films, and the genre just kind of exploded, but now you're getting these really weird variations on the superhero genre, and we've seen them in the past couple of years. Last year, we had a movie called Kick-Ass, which was kind of interesting. I mean, Kick-Ass was a straight-up adaptation of a comic book, so it wasn't really a parody or anything completely out of left field. What made Kick-Ass different was that it was kind of harsh, you know. The violence was very, very real. There was some harsh language in it. And Nicolas Cage with a mustache. That's another, of course, bit of crazy.
It sounds harsh.
Nick Cage is actually really good in that film. And the movie itself is kind of an interesting concept of, like, what happens if there's a real high school kid decides to be a vigilante. And, like, how do people that are criminals, how do they handle that fact? It's a fun movie. I don't want to, overstate its awesomeness or anything, because it's not awesome. But it is kind of enjoyable. And Matthew Vaughn, of course, is the man who directed X-Men First Class. That was his movie that sort of, I think, got him the job to direct X-Men First Class. So I think Kick-Ass is kind of worth seeing. Of course, available on instant viewing on Netflix if you want to check it out. But it's not for the kids. It's definitely very, very brutally violent. And there's been a couple of movies just in the last year that took a weird, slant of the superhero genre. There was a movie called Chronicle, which I really liked. And that was one of those kind of found footage movies, you know what I mean, where... Well, like the Blair Witch Project, I guess, started that whole approach.
Yes.
But basically, it's about these guys that kind of develop superpowers after contact with some meteor or some silly like that. But it's all like first person, you know, it's shot by the characters, and then they, as they develop these powers, they start kind of pulling them in different directions ideologically. You know, one guy starts abusing his power, the other guy starts using it for good. And it was interesting in the film the way these characters kind of come apart. Not too dissimilar from X-Men First Class conceptually, but done in this found footage way, you know, with lots of shaky cam, which does annoy people, but it's handled very well, because one of the powers these guys develop is kind of a telekinetic power. They can levitate objects. Uh-huh. One of the objects they start levitating is the camera, because they're documenting everything that happens.
Oh.
So once they develop the power, the camera starts flying around them, so there's none of this handshake happening and none of the cliches. Now you can actually see a scene between two of the main characters, and you don't have to worry about who's holding the camera. And that's kind of inspired in the film. And that film's pretty good, actually. Also, Boy Wonder, which I saw recently, which is more like which is kind of a vigilante film with a superhero slant to it, and that's not as good. I mean, I'm not really gonna go too much into it, but it's just brutal, and we've seen it before. I don't think it really offers any new angle on the genre or the vigilante genre for that matter. So skip that one.
You know, it used to just be that a superhero movie would just kind of fall under the umbrella of an action movie.
Right.
But now it really does seem as if the superhero picture is its own viable genre, because we're seeing low-budget versions
right.
of these films.
Well, both the films I just mentioned were fairly low-budget.
Yeah, and I saw recently a film from 2011 called Super, mm-hmm. and it's... You know, it has known actors in it. It stars Rainn Wilson from The Office, mm-hmm. and Ellen Page is in it, Nathan Fillion, Liv Tyler. So there's some actors you would recognize
in
this.
Yeah, that's a good cast.
I mean, that said, the whole movie was probably, I would say, about $5 million, if I had to guess. Maybe
okay.
5 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
And Super is a really interesting movie because it the whole premise is Rainn Wilson, you know, his wife disappears on him, and he thinks, correctly or not, that his wife has been kidnapped by this local kind of drug dealer, played by Kevin Bacon. And so he decides he wants to get her back, and he becomes inspired to become his own superhero and fight crime in the process. So he makes his own costume, and he calls himself the Crimson Bolt. And it's fairly comical. I mean, you know, Rainn Wilson seems kind of pathetic, and his costume is very clearly handmade.
Right.
You know, not like the new Spider-Man.
Which it would be.
Yes, not like the new Spider-Man movie where suddenly these characters turn into some sort of...
$20,000 outfit.
Yeah. So he's got this kind of patchwork costume, and he tries to fight crime in his own way, and it doesn't go all that well because he has no training, he has no background or anything. But the movie takes a turn where he decides that he needs, he's like, well, I got to get some sort of weapon, you know, to fight
right,
crime,
right.
rather than just my fist, because I'm not that big a guy. So he settles on a large wrench.
That's a good choice, actually. You don't see
a huge
that a
wrench.
Lot of hammers
yeah, well,
over you.
Well,
these
I mean,
days.
So then you see him, you know, he goes up to someone in his costume who's mugging, and he's like, shut up, crime, and it's comical. But then he hits this guy in the face with a wrench. And the movie, it's not like a comic book hit in the face. I mean, blood starts spurting. You know, this guy might be deformed. And
sure.
So, you know, I don't want to ruin it from there on, but I will. I highly recommend Super because it has a strange tone to it, that it doesn't shy away from the patheticness or the ridiculousness of these schlubs who want to be heroes. But the violence is somewhat real. And the best thing about the movie is it doesn't tell you how you should feel about it.
Right.
It just kind of puts the comical aspects and the horrifying violent aspects, it just mixes them all up together and lets you kind of sort out, like, well, am I okay with this? Am I not okay with this? Where do I stand on this character? And lets you figure it out.
Doesn't chew it up for you. I always like that. It sounds like a good double feature with kick-ass, it seems.
Both Rainn Wilson and Ellen Page give great performances.
Really?
Ellen Page is really different and more aggressive than we're used to her. And Rainn Wilson just fully commits to, you know, he's schlubby, but there's not a self-aware level of irony to his schlubbiness.
Right, he's not Jack Black.
No. In this film, he is a schlub guy who is actually very... not aware of some of his actions and what they mean.
Right.
But yeah, you check out Super if you're looking for a variation. Like Kick-Ass, please do not show this to your children. I mean, there's horrifying violence, really bad language. I mean, it is a hard R.
Getting back to the very mainstream superhero.
Well, this year there's been some big guns unveiled.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, I think the Avengers is sort of the comic book geek's wet dream, you know? I mean, it the fact that there was a straight up Avengers movie is something that I would have barely believed as a 14-year-old reading Avengers comic book.
With multiple big-name actors.
With multiple big-name actors, all of them well-cast, with a big budget. All the elements were there to either make a giant hit or just to have a giant disaster. I mean, it could have really gone either way. I think the movie like that would have made money no matter what, but artistically, it could have been just an absolute train wreck.
Oh, sure. Could have gone way off the rails.
And I think its biggest accomplishment really is the fact that it didn't, is that it actually does work pretty well. It's a fun movie.
The Avengers is really fun, and it made all the money. And, I mean, not only did they pull it off, did Joss Whedon pull it off, but he just pulled it off with charm, and it doesn't feel like a labored movie. It just feels like an entertaining superhero flick, and they just get on with their business, and, yeah, it doesn't feel like a lot of studio hands straining to make this work. It just exists.
Yeah, it seems to be fairly organic. Avengers is not a film that that takes itself too seriously either, and I think that works. I think Marvel found actually a pretty good tone that for most of the films that they've put out, starting with Iron Man, where it's comfortable being a comic book. Give you a comic book story with a comic book resolution, with a happy ending, with the good guys prevailing over the bad guys, and not really a hell of a lot more than that. I mean, you gotta say, I mean, Avengers doesn't have a hell of a lot to say about anything.
No.
It's just a very, very solidly constructed adventure film with lots of great action, pretty clever dialogue, and characters that interact together in an entertaining way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan of Joss Whedon's previous work. You know, like, I like Buffy and Firefly, and I'm not one of those guys who thinks everything he touches is automatic genius. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm a fan of his writing. He did a run on a series of X-Men comics, which actually was really good. And so if you like Joss Whedon's writing, you know that he does have a talent for this about mixing action and comedy, mm-hmm. and also with ensembles. Which is the other place where the Avengers really triumphs for me is that you kind of feel everybody gets their own fair share.
I agree.
The other danger with a movie like this is that, you know, you would have the movie going along and then you could almost hear the sound of Scarlett Johansson's agent on the phone, and all of a sudden one of the characters would have a really horribly inorganic subplot. You know, or some Robert Downey Jr. would bitch that he needed more screen time in the third act. You know, something like that.
Yeah.
And the film, you feel like all the members of the Avengers team kind of get their own appropriate level in the spotlight, and you kind of get to know them all.
Yeah, absolutely. And another cool thing is that, like, Tom Hiddleston, who plays Loki, both in the Thor and the Avengers, actually really comes into his own as a character in this film.
He does, yeah.
Exactly what I was saying about Thor, where there wasn't really much to him. He didn't have a lot of screen time, and a lot of his, you know, evil misdeeds were essentially done either off screen or just kind of were just basic lies, like, oh, he said that about you, and he seemed like it was the level of evil of like a middle school preteen girl type of a thing. Where in this movie, he's genuinely threatening and creepy and manipulative and friggin' evil, you know. So when he gets his, it's, you know, when the Hulk gets him towards the end of the movie, it's like a moment where, like, the audience just jumps to their feet and applauds.
The part where the Hulk smashes Loki is one of the loudest bursts of audience laughter I've heard in years.
In years, absolutely. It's just one, and this is exactly what I was saying before. This is one of those moments of sheer delight in the film that, together with other excellent moments in the film and fine performances and a clever script, that combine to make exactly what most people want from a movie like that, which is a dose of escapism, a chance to forget your reality for a couple of hours, a little nostalgia because you remember back to the times when you were reading these comic books as a kid, and, you know, if the movie references some of those moments, it somehow pushes a delight button in your brain. So that's mission accomplished with the Avengers. I mean, great job, and the proof's in the pudding. Everybody loves the movie. It's now kind of a measuring stick, or a new measuring stick, certainly for a certain kind of superhero movie, and they knocked it out of the park, it seems to me.
Yeah, they did a great job. I want to give a special shout-out, too, to one of those things which I thought might work, but worked great, was the casting of Mark Ruffalo as Bruce Banner in this.
Right.
And, I mean, I've always... Mark Ruffalo is one of my favorite American actors, and you know, kind of the current generation. And I thought he would be great. What I didn't know would work so well is Mark Ruffalo's kind of rumpled intellectual and Robert Downey Jr.'s slightly dickish playboy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those guys practically had their own comedy routine going on, and you see them drive off together at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And you're like, man, I'd watch a movie just of Iron Man and the Hulk hanging out for 2 hours.
You know, it is funny because though it was a very, very good rapport, but virtually everybody has a pretty good
rapport. Yes,
and they paired up certain characters
correct.
In a certain way, you know, and sometimes they paired up their alter egos and then their heroic characters, like Iron Man was paired up with Captain America, as it was, of course, as they were in the Civil War comic series, you know, where they're very different and there's a lot of headbutting going on there. But the alter egos, it was Tony Stark and Bruce Banner.
Yeah.
You know, so that it was sort of this kind of twisting around like a Rubik's Cube was kind of fun to do. And it was well done. And what do you think of the whole 3D thing? I mean, all the Marvel things are 3D now. And I'm not a big fan of 3D overall, but it didn't really bother me. I saw the Avengers in 3D and in 2D, and I liked the 3D. I thought, I don't know if it was worth the extra $5 I paid for the 3D, but it didn't take away from the film. It didn't seem fairly gimmicky, and there were parts of it that were kind of breathtaking, especially during the gigantic action sequence that the film goes into in that second hour.
I actually did not see the Avengers in 3D. I did pony up for the 3D for Spider-Man. But for the Avengers, I just saw the 2D aspect.
Right, right. Well, the Avengers, like all the other Marvel movies, is a converted 3D. So the director will always give you the spiel like, well, they pre-planned it to be converted into 3D, so they shot it a certain way. And usually I don't necessarily feel that. I mean, it was a little bit forced in Captain America. I didn't see Thor in 3D, but you could see shots in it that are very, like, aimed at the 3D experience.
Sure.
With a hammer flying in your face and stuff like that. But it was much more organic in the Avengers, and it worked a lot better, especially during the big action scene in Manhattan, where there's lots of stuff flying at you, but you're also flying with stuff and with characters. That was pretty cool, actually. The Amazing Spider-Man, of course, was filmed in 3D, so it was actually designed as a 3D.
Yeah, which was part of the reason I ponied up for it, and also just figured that Spider-Man slinging through the towering canyons of Manhattan would be a pretty cool...
Would be amazing.
That would be cool.
Amazing. It would be. How did that turn out?
Not as well. I mean, I will say the shots of him flying through, they were cool. They weren't amazing.
Right. Yeah.
The bigger problem with The Amazing Spider-Man in general is that movie's just so mediocre.
The biggest issue with it is, of course, the big question is why. Spider-Man 1 came out 10 years ago, and here it is 10 years later, and they are completely rebooting the franchise. And this is what surprised me about The Amazing Spider-Man, is that they completely rebooted it. They gave him a new origin story. They tied in that origin story very clumsily with the villain storyline, which was the Lizard in this case. And it was just unnecessary. It just seemed like, why do that? Why does this need to be recreated? And if you are recreating it, why does it have to be so pedestrian?
You know, the only hope I had about, you know, them redoing the movie was, yeah, maybe it'll be more of a wacky high school tale.
So if you're going to reboot a franchise that close to the original, you're going to inevitably face comparisons to that franchise. And this movie, sadly, does not compare favorably to the Sam Raimi franchise.
Well, yeah, if you're going to redo it, you should just do something totally different with
right.
it, which is what they claim they were doing. But the reality is it just seemed like a blander version of the same
thing. It seemed like a remake of Spider-Man 1 with a lot of things that made Spider-Man 1 so enjoyable, just stripped out of it. I hated the whole thing with Uncle Ben. I thought that was clunky. I didn't like the whole, like, the mechanical web shooters thing. Even though I can somehow magically accept that a radioactive spider could bite somebody and give them powers of a giant spider, I find it much more far-fetched that a teenager can design web shooters that contain one of the most amazing substances ever made by man. Those webs are, they're strong as steel, Steve. It's a revolutionary invention. It could change the world, an invention like that. And this guy invents this in high school, puts them on his wrist, and uses them to be a superhero. And what he does in the movie, that's not even what happens in the movie. What happens in the movie is he orders them off the fucking internet, Steve.
That's right.
What the hell? I mean, he orders this amazing thing off the internet. The whole thing, like, this is a guy who has no money. He's struggling. He's supporting his aunt.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking even about his costume, which is so over-engineered and looks so absolutely impossible for any normal person to design or build. But having said all that, Spider-Man in action is cool in this movie. Like,
yeah, that's, I went and saw this movie. My son is 4 and he's aware that there's a Spider-Man movie out.
Mm-hmm.
And my gut reaction, I tell him, you got to be a little older. I think it's PG-13.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
But so I went to see the movie, and with kind of the thought, I'll keep an eye out to see if there's objectionable things about maybe he would be able to see it. And I kind of came away thinking that there wasn't anything necessarily I would object to, except he would be so bored. He would just be so bored.
Wow.
And the first hour of this movie is so deathly boring. Now, I will say the second hour, when he finally, he doesn't put the Spider-Man costume on until hour 2. The lizard doesn't get created until hour 2. But the second hour is a bit better. Once it becomes like a more action-y film, it's
right.
It's not terrible.
And there is a lot of action, and the 3D is cool. But, the lizard, I hate the lizard design in the movie. The lizard doesn't look realistic, or not even realistic. It just doesn't look cool. I don't like that design at all. So that was off-putting.
Yeah, I did like I can never say his name right, Ralph Fiennes, the man who plays the lizard. I thought he did a fine job, but...
Yeah, Ralph Fiennes.
Once he fully became the lizard, not only was it somewhat fakey, it just wasn't the coolest looking.
Right, and I do like Emma Stone, and Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield have a good rapport. There's some genuine chemistry between those two. But, it was overplayed in the movie. There were these scenes where, why is this scene going on and on? Nothing is happening. Story isn't progressing. We've already established that these two are falling in love. There's no need to have them sit there and just give each other googly eyes for an additional 3 minutes of barely necessary dialogue.
Well, then there's this weird generic level of angst just draped over the top of all of that. So the high school stuff, nothing is light on its feet. And the romantic, in quotes, comedy stuff is also not really light on its feet.
Well, it's not funny. There's no comedy there.
I'm with you. I like those actors. And Emma Stone, could probably charm anybody.
Sure.
But if you're going in that thinking, I'm going to watch a romantic comedy that happens to be about a superhero... It's not a particularly charming romantic comedy.
Yeah, this is not the more lighthearted version of Spider-Man. I mean, it's darker than the Sam Raimi films.
It is.
and so I don't get the point, but the movie made money, so there's probably going to be another Spider-Man.
It's already scheduled. It has a date scheduled.
Yeah,
and,
it's coming.
I mean, in answer to your why, and I can't recall where I read this, if this is rumor or fact, but I've found the word going around the street, Andre, is that the biggest reason this movie exists is contractual, in that unlike the Avengers and Captain America and Thor, those movie rights are owned by Marvel directly, Sony owns the movie rights to Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Marvel sold them the movie rights back in the 90s or whenever.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently there's some part of the deal where if Sony goes so long without making a Spider-Man movie, then the rights get reverted back to Marvel.
Right.
Which is something I'm sure Marvel would love. They'd love to get the movie rights for that.
I'd love it, because then you could throw Spider-Man into the Avengers movies.
Exactly.
It'd be great.
Well, so Sony didn't want to let that happen, and therefore they fast-tracked this kind of half-baked Spider-Man.
Really. Yeah, yeah, it's too bad. It was disappointing, but not terrible. But in my view, I liked it better than you did, regardless of everything I've said. But I mean, overall, it was just kind of like a weird. There were just weird choices made here.
Yeah.
And that's too bad. But again, not not a complete disaster in my book. Well, of course, the second most anticipated superhero movie of the year was...
well, probably the most anticipated.
You would put this ahead of the Avengers? You would put The Dark Knight Rises to be more anticipated than the Avengers?
I would argue The Dark Knight Rises is the most anticipated movie of this entire year.
So what did you think of The Dark Knight Rises?
I liked it a lot. I will say, the movie comes with so much hype and such expectation. Mm-hmm. Not just culturally, but for me personally, you know, like I loved The Dark Knight. And so, you know, I've only seen it once at this point. It's impossible to just fully judge this movie on its own merits.
Right.
And I mean, obviously it ties into the previous ones, but just you can't watch it in a vacuum and divorce it from expectations and everything. So that said, I go into this type of movie kind of just hoping that they don't drop the ball. You know, like, don't fuck it up here at the end. Don't embarrass yourself.
Right.
Make some choices that seem, you know, not in sync with the other two movies. And based on that criteria, I think it was a flying success.
I loved it. I mean, I think I liked it more than you did. And I'm a little surprised that I loved it as much as I did, Steve, because, you know, the movie did come with a lot of baggage, and it came with a lot of expectations vis-a-vis The Dark Knight, and also Dark Knight, Batman Begins, which I really like. I mean, to me, Batman Begins presents the best, in my view, superhero origin story that I've ever encountered in a movie. I think that movie handled the origin of Batman brilliantly, and that is not actually an easy origin to deal with. And then The Dark Knight comes along, and that movie is, you know, just blows everybody away. That is a dense crime drama with unforgettable moments in it, but also, you know, the Heath Ledger performance, you can't overlook that. That's a stunning performance.
It's an amazing performance. That is a role that I frankly didn't see how they were going to do it. That, you know, through years of comic books and Jack Nicholson's performance and just the various incarnations of the Joker over the years, I was really unsure of how that character was going to be integrated into the realistic world that Christopher Nolan had created. I had no idea how they were going to do it. I kind of thought it had a large potential to fall on its face.
Uh-huh.
And people forget that at the time of the casting, the Heath Ledger casting of this Joker was kind of strange.
It was
strange.
I
mean, he was a fairly respected young actor, but
yeah.
You know, he's a young guy. He wasn't even 30, and you're just...
Right.
Nothing really in his filmography would make you think, you know who'd be an excellent Joker? Heath Ledger.
Right.
And he, I mean, the combo of Heath Ledger, Christopher Nolan, and the makeup artist, I mean, they just knocked that thing so far out of the park to the point where, I mean, that's arguably, what, like the kind of gold standard of the current view of what the Joker should be like.
Well, yeah, it's zeitgeist changing. I mean, it's absolutely definitive, and it was brilliant. But, you know, that sort of takes you back to the expectation aspect.
Yes, that's what you can't. Well, The Dark Knight Rises to me is, it's not, you know, people liked Batman Begins, me among them, and it was a big hit. It's not like a tiny movie.
Right.
All that said, I will say The Dark Knight took people by surprise.
Yeah.
That people, it was a lot better, I think, than people thought it was going to be.
Right.
And The Dark Knight Rises, it's not going to take anyone by surprise.
It's actually the almost the opposite of that. I mean, The Dark Knight Rises now has to live up to the higher expectations, to the raised bar that's set by The Dark Knight. So the expectations for The Dark Knight Rises, of course, sets it up for a disappointment. And, you know, the reviews on it overall are mixed. You know, some people don't like the film. Some people are really, really disappointed with the film. And I really don't understand what the hell those people are talking about. Because I think The Dark Knight Rises, first of all, is an excellent conclusion to the Christopher Nolan trilogy of Batman. I think there's so much going on in the movie. I think it's action-packed. I mean, wonderfully action-packed. I think it's very well acted. I think the character development works out great. You know, it's just satisfying. I found it incredibly satisfying and kind of triumphant. I think it ends it in on a real up note that took me by surprise. I gotta say, you know, I expected the film also to be a little bit more dark and a little bit more self-consciously trying to make a metaphorical statements about the world we live in. Like, there was a lot of talk that they were filming during the Occupy protest in New York, and that was going to become part of the movie. And that is not altogether untrue. But the thing is, it doesn't weigh itself down with all that stuff. It tells a Batman story in a straightforward way. It's a Batman story that tied into all the way to Batman Begins, and it ends in a way that works and just is effective and honest and true to the trilogy.
Yeah, I will say that I had read some reviews that some people were saying, you know, and even reading it smacked kind of publicity hype of like, oh, it's actually the darkest of the three movies.
I don't think so.
To me, I think The Dark Knight still way lighter than The Dark Knight, and The Dark Knight ends on a much bleaker note.
Well, certainly.
And philosophical heaviness is there in The Dark Knight. And like you say, in The Dark Knight Rises, it's, you know, the kind of wealth inequality and things, it's there, but it is kind of more of a flavoring of a superhero movie.
It's part of the palette. It's not designed to be a metaphor for the economic divide facing the world right now. It's not. And it's just there, though. It's on the table. Just like terrorism was on the table in the first film, and the response to terrorism was on the table for the second film. You know, they use the world we live in as a palette. But what goes on top of the palette is a story of Batman.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, there were some aspects in this one that were even a little borderline silly.
Sure.
It didn't really bother me that much. But, you know, one of the things I kind of chuckled about is, you know, from the time where Bane beats up Batman till the climax of the movie, that was 5 months.
There was a lot of,
it's a long time.
Yeah, the movie takes place over a large period of time, and a lot happens. You know, there's an epic quality to it. There's a genuine epic quality to Batman. And, I mean, it moves at a breakneck pace, because the film picks up 8 years after the end of the Dark Knight. And, you know, what's cool, I really like Christian Bale in this film. I think this is his best performance as Bruce Wayne, because not only he does, like, he looks older, he looks kind of like leaner, drier, you know, he looks like an older dude, which is kind of surprising since he's not old, you know, but he, in the movie, he feels like an older guy, which is certainly different, because just 7 years ago, he felt like a fairly young guy in Batman Begins, you know? So there's that progression, and there's just so much that happens in the film, and it just, like, it skips time, it moves forward. It's just, it's chock full of stuff. And it's also chock full of just fun little references to the comics that I enjoy, you know, from Catwoman's little sidekick, you know, which you see in Batman Year One, we used to be called Spoiler Alert, but I guess, you know, I don't mind spoiling stuff.
We spoiled other things earlier. If you're still listening at this point, you should know that, we're just going to openly discuss.
Well, I mean, there is a Robin in this movie, even though he's not jumping around in a pair of Speedos and a cape. Of course, there was a lot of rumors as to how he's going to, does he kill Batman and stuff like that. And, of course, he does not kill Batman. You guys can relax, although, you know, it's pretty touch and go there for a few minutes, and there's some definite question marks as to how exactly Batman manages to survive. But I won't give away more than that. I think I've given away enough. But what do you think of the Catwoman there?
I actually really liked her. I wasn't sure going in. I'm generally, I guess I'm kind of generally pro Anne Hathaway, but I'm not super pro Anne Hathaway. And I thought she did a great job.
She
I thought that character was pretty interesting, and how it flowed in with Batman all felt fairly believable. Mm-hmm. And no, I really liked her. And I also was I was really impressed with Joseph Gordon-Levitt's John Blake character.
Right,
I wasn't
exactly
sure how that was going to get integrated in. Again, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is an actor I've enjoyed him in many movies.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
You know, he's almost like the co-lead of the film.
Yeah.
He kind of takes over some of the Gordon stuff, even though Gordon is in it.
I liked
his whole character arc.
Yeah, but he's also an interesting cop. You could follow him for the movie, and you could stick with him. And when you're watching him, you're not thinking, God, I need Batman right now. And, you know, another thing I got to mention is there's a lot of fucking Batman in this
movie.
Like in The Dark Knight, there wasn't enough Batman.
Yeah, sometimes
but they
Batman
had the
disappears.
Joker kind of take the front, and then there was, of course, Two-Face as well. But in this movie, there's a lot of Batman. There's a lot of Christian Bale. There's that character is definitely front and center in the film. And I'm with you. I liked Anne Hathaway. I like their take on the Catwoman and the way she is, and that she has kind of a philosophy that's interesting and creates an interesting alternative to Bruce Wayne's take of the world and so on and so forth. So,
and one of the things which they used in this movie, which, I mean, what I'm going to say doesn't sound at all subtle, but they had a really subtle take on it, was that, you know, the first scene where Batman kind of meets Catwoman, I don't mean Bruce Wayne, I mean where he's in Batman garb.
Right.
The two of them kind of, it seems like they just instinctually start fighting people together. Partly because you could argue they have a shared enemy, but also there's just something of like, hey, you're in a costume, I'm in a costume.
Right.
You know, and the movie, it's like it's there if you want to see that there is some. I mean, like, just right. Watching it, you're like, well, the two people in costume should be on the same team, right? Because everybody else is not in costume.
That's right.
So it's like, you know, you see somebody in your profession, and you're like, oh, that, you know, she's in the club, right?
Right, right.
And
yeah, when they do hook up in a superhero way, it's very satisfying, you know?
It just seems
when they
like
go through
sense.
A bunch of
yeah,
bad
like,
guys, and it's like, yeah.
I mean, as weird as it sounds, it seemed almost like if one plumber ran into another plumber, it's like, oh, I
they'd start plumbing together.
Who's your tailor?
Yeah, exactly. So that was fun. I mean, Bane clearly is kind of a more of a thuggish character. He's thuggish in the comics.
Sure.
I read the story of Bane and back then it didn't make a huge impression on me. They completely changed him for this film, and a lot of the fanboys are upset, actually.
I have nothing invested in Bane whatsoever.
Right.
So I could just enjoy the Tom Hardy Bane. I brought no baggage at all to it.
Yeah.
And I found Bane very captivating.
Well, he's scary and intimidating, you know. The mask, I gotta say, it's hard to rise above a mask as an actor. I mean, you could argue he's got more of a mask than Batman does.
He does. I mean, it's really, his eyes are there, but even his eyes are, I mean, the mask is pinched all around his nose. And,
yeah.
It really does take a lot of his expressive qualities away.
Yeah, it is. You know, I question that choice a little bit. Again, Dark Knight Rises is not a perfect movie. There's a lot of goofiness in it.
One of the controversies before the movie came out was, is Bane unintelligible? Probably because
right.
they had him mumbling through the mask a little.
Right.
And I could understand Bane pretty well for almost all the movie. It was clear that Bane's dialogue was mixed differently than everybody else's.
Oh, yeah. It felt like it was.
You know, like Bane's in a scene and all the other people are talking, then all of a sudden Bane starts talking and it's you're getting in a voice from a studio far away.
Well, that character, that voice is going to get more. It's funny, I think, remember in Dark Knight when that came out, everybody made fun of the way Christian Bale talked as Batman.
Yes.
So now they actually, in this movie, they raise the stakes.
Because
now Bane talks so much weirder than Batman ever talked.
It's another thing they took, I think they took into account, because Christian Bale, I felt, walked a line in this movie of not abandoning the old Batman voice, but maybe toning it down.
Well, I think it was a mix. You know, I think the problem with the Dark Knight Batman voice is that it was digitally enhanced somehow.
What seemed ridiculous is in The Dark Knight, there's multiple scenes where Batman is just talking to Gordon or Dent or people who are not criminals and people who may even have some inkling of who he is. And so, but he did not lay off the voice at all.
Right,
so, you know, the joke
sticks with the persona.
The joke I always made was that, you know, there's this scene in that movie of Dent and Gordon and Batman on a roof talking about what they're going to do. You know, and I just imagine an alternate take where Gordon's like, you know, Batman, you can tone it down. It's just us, you know. I mean, you guys want to order a pizza? We do, but it's, you know, it's, you don't need to bark at me. It's just relax a bit.
How about a lozenge?
That's right.
Yeah, but, well, it is better. But, you know, getting back to Bane, the Bane voice, you know, he does something very, very stylized with his whole vocal delivery. It's hard to tell. Like, he kind of has an accent.
Yeah, it seems vaguely British,
It is. And then it also reminds me of somebody's speech pattern, somebody famous.
You know, like, what worked really well for me for the Bane character was that, you know, this physically imposing man who is just one completely sure of himself. And, you know, every scene in the movie, that's he just struts in like he has no fear of anything.
Right. Yeah, completely fearless character, and you know, and also a character totally without any sort of qualms, you know.
Will
kill anybody. He doesn't particularly care. What's amazing to me with characters like that always, and that's always seems to be a little bit of a eye roll for me, is that, you know, whenever a guy like that has an army behind him who worship him as a god, I always question, like, once he murders his second lieutenant and then he murders the guy that replaces that guy, like, how much loyalty is that guy is he really gonna inspire in his troops? Oh, Bane killed my buddy again for the third time this week. Snapped his neck for nothing.
If you look at a
come on,
if you look at a company and who suddenly like fires a bunch of people,
yeah,
like the general vibe at the company is like, oh my god, am I next? It's not. You know what?
My head's on the chopping block. In this case, it's really on the chopping block.
Yeah. No, it doesn't inspire increased devotion.
It is very, very weird, you know. And then there's the whole thing where they take over the city, you know. And they take over the city for months, you know, nothing. And they threaten it with nuclear explosions. And it's just like, and, you know, within the city, like, they never really get into, like, what are people living like. You know, it's like the general citizens of the city seems to be either hiding or have openly joined Bane's army, you know, and it's like, it'd be nice to see, like, where are they getting their food from? You know, like, are they just eating a lot of canned goods? Are the restaurants still open? What's happening? You know, like, what's the night scene? You know, is everybody just hiding?
I can't disagree with all of that, but I did enjoy that they did actually seem to set up a fairly viable, what it was like for kind of the underground resistance during that time. Like, that I did get a picture of.
I thought
of,
that was cool,
you know, methods of communicating with the cops underground and all this other.
Right,
and how the cops above ground, like, their systems for passing notes. And I did think that was kind of cool. In a very short amount of time, you did get a sense of, like, oh, this is, you know, life in the resistance.
Right.
Similarly, it was a pretty large pill to swallow, the idea that the U.S. government would let its largest city just be, you know, taken over by a foreign power for 5 months. Like, for 5 months. I mean, in this day and age, when, like, the press, like, if something goes 3 days,
people are
pounding their fists, like, how much longer must we wait on a decision on this?
Well,
and the idea then that just, you know, that there are cops just on the other side of that bridge who are just more or less, just hang out. We're going to see what happens here.
Right. Well, they didn't just take over the city. They, you know, they clearly murdered hundreds, at least hundreds
of
people.
Sure, and they're threatening everyone with a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not a situation where any government on the planet is going to go, you know what, let's see how this plays out.
I don't know. I mean, that part of me, there was a great scene, you know, where they're listening to the radio and the president comes on and he goes, people of Gotham, we have not abandoned you. And Gordon turns off the radio and goes, okay, we're on our own.
Yeah.
I love that. You know, the cynicism of that was right on the money. And I dug that.
I really liked Gordon in this one too.
Yeah.
I've always loved Gary Oldman. I've specifically liked his Gordon, but, a lot of times I felt like, I don't know, it just seemed a little underused in these movies.
Mm-hmm.
And this I got a good Gordon sense.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the whole combination of you know, he's guilty about the whole Harvey Dent deception, and at the same time, he's sort of leading the resistance from a hospital, and it's just, you know, it's fun. It just all works. Also, another thing, not 3D.
No.
Good choice not to have it 3D. Did you see it in IMAX?
I did not.
I saw it in IMAX, and it was great. The IMAX added to the experience, even though it subtracted from my pocketbook. But that was crazy expensive. But the IMAX works. It works great in that movie. Like, a lot of that film was shot in IMAX. So seeing it in that format is actually pretty impressive visually. There's
maybe I will
no
check
question
it out.
About it.
Yeah.
I want to see the film again. I liked it that much, and I'm going to see it again. That's it. I've made my decision. So that covers most of the superhero movies that came out in the last couple of years. What's on the horizon, Steve?
Superhero-wise?
Yes.
What is on the horizon, Super? Let's see. I mean, there's supposedly rebooting the Fantastic Four. Similar to Spider-Man, mm-hmm. where it's another case where Marvel doesn't have the rights.
Uh-huh, where Sony just wants to reboot it. Well,
yeah,
to
try and make
some
money off that.
They couldn't make that worse. And I'm not knocking Sony either because, you know, I mean, a lot depends on the producer, the director, the writer. I mean, that's really where the heart of the film is. And Fantastic Four, I don't particularly want to see a Fantastic Four Avengers team up. I mean, if it comes, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
But I'm not jonesing for that. I think Fantastic Four needs to be self-contained. And since the last Fantastic Four movies were so bad, this could only be an improvement.
Yeah. So coming in the next couple of years, you know, we've got a Thor 2. We're going to have an Iron Man 3. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a sequel to X-Men First Class. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure they've greenlit an Avengers sequel.
Well, yeah, that's
And there's a major reboot coming next summer.
That's right. Superman, Man of Steel is coming, which was, of course, previewed before The Dark Knight. That preview looked really good to me. I don't know. I mean, it was weird, but it looked cool. I think I actually have, like, some high hopes for Man of Steel. I don't know why. But I
got to say I don't. So when the movie comes out, maybe we'll get together again and compare notes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, at this pace, we may be doing a superhero 3 installment as well. But for now, I'm Andre Shane.
I'm Steve Askin.
We'll talk to you next time. Let's go.